Today in Studio 360, was there something Tennessee Williams didn't tell us about Blanche DuBois?
So she says, oh yes, my American ancestors were French Huguenot. That's the line. And so if you say it as my American ancestors, the others were African.
A new improved Broadway production of Streetcar Named Desire. Plus, you can like her characters or not. Filmmaker Sarah Polley doesn't care.
This idea that we have to like everybody all the time makes for really boring movies. There's no room for tension or for things to be truly funny when everyone has to be nice all the time.
And Sarah Polley is one of those artists who makes it look like we're at the beginning of a golden age for women directors. That plus a live performance by Dirty Projectors, all ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
There was a single one, then there were ten.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Coming up on the show today, I've noticed lately that more and more of my favorite new movies are being made by women. They're mostly indie films. Are things finally reaching a tipping point for women in Hollywood? I'll talk about that later in the program with the directors Lynn Shelton and Sarah Polley. But first, by now, everybody has heard of Comic-Con International, the giant comic book pop culture extravaganza that happens every year in San Diego. But I only recently realized how giant and how important to the culture industry it's become. Right now, at this year's version, 125,000 people are geeking out at the San Diego Convention Center. And that doesn't count all the film stars and TV people on hand to court those fans. What started in 1970 as a swap meet for a few hundred comic book collectors has now become the place where pop culture business and the fans meet and set the agendas for the rest of us. Rob Salkowitz knows both sides better than most people. He is a business analyst and a longtime comic book fan. His new book is Comic-Con and the Business of Pop Culture, and he joins me now from San Diego. Welcome to Studio 360, Rob.
Thanks, Kurt.
So in the book, you write, comics are the hamster running in the wheel at the center of this gigantic media contraption, but the hamster is sick. You're there looking over the convention center with 125,000 people. How is the hamster sick?
Well, this is what's interesting, is the entertainment industry these days is running on what I call comics culture, and it's this whole nexus of genre entertainment based in superheroes. It comes fundamentally from this medium of comic books. In that metaphor, I was referring to the traditional comics publishing industry, the people who publish their comic books and sell them through traditional comic book stores. That has been the center of comic culture for the last 25 years,
right?
And that's really what's under a lot of pressure right now.
So even though half of Hollywood is devoted to producing X-Men and other comic book-based movies, the new Batman, television has Walking Dead, you're saying the underlying ore for that, which are just paper, old-fashioned paper comic books, are going away. But is that any different than what's happening elsewhere, kind of in the media and culture industry?
There's a lot of changes in the way that comics are being distributed, going from paper to being digital, same as in other industries around the world. But rarely is the gap between the popularity of the content and the business struggles of the medium quite as profound as it is in this case, where you've got, you know, conventions that get that feature two times the average readership of the best-selling comic.
Really?
So, you know, if there's 130,000 people, 140,000 people coming to San Diego for this Comic-Con, routinely the best-selling comic book is selling 70,000 to 80,000 titles per month.
Hollywood shows up as though this is an obligatory pilgrimage. I read that Peter Jackson, the moment he finished filming The Hobbit in New Zealand, had to come to Comic-Con. They need each other, obviously, the industry or industries and the fans. But is the relationship fraught?
It is. It's a very complicated relationship. I mean, I think Comic-Con and comics culture and the fans and Hollywood are like two black holes staring across each other in space, each warping reality around them in their own particular ways. When Hollywood first started coming to Comic-Con in earnest in the early 2000s, 2003, 2004, and you got this real megawatt star power here for the first time, and you would see Bruce Willis or Angelina Jolie or Will Smith or some of the very top names in Hollywood, that was energizing, I think, for the talent, and it was certainly energizing for the fans. And it was a little like, you know, oh, the captain of the football team is coming over to sit at the nerd table in the cafeteria.
Yes.
Now that it's more a routine business, we may be at the point of diminishing returns.
In your book, you use the word transmedia a lot. Explain what you mean by that.
Transmedia is basically this process of taking a story that is being told traditionally in one medium, say comics or books, and adapting it to another medium, say movies or video games, and being able to take the elements of the story that play best in each particular medium and using that.
Well, and I will give one of the older, earlier 20th century examples of comic strips like Little Orphan Annie or Dick Tracy or Superman becoming radio programs in the 30s.
One of the most sophisticated examples of that was with Little Orphan Annie, where you would read the comic strip in the newspaper. They would give you a code. You would listen to the radio broadcast to learn how to set your decoder dial, and then you would decode the message and get bonus content.
The moment you hang up, are you going to walk downstairs and enter the fray at Comic-Con?
I have to go and get my badge, which is a fray unto itself, and then if I can get onto the floor a little bit early, I would like to go and do that.
Well, thanks so much for making time to talk to me today.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Rob Salkowitz is the author of Comic-Con and the Business of Pop Culture. So Rob and I talked about kids back in the old days decoding Little Orphan Annie's messages.
For all you 1936 members of Orphan Annie's Secret Society, we're going to broadcast another secret message in Annie's mystery radio code.
Well, we've got a code for you. And if you crack it, you'll get a special behind-the-scenes look at the current Comic-Con. Get your pencils ready. Here comes the code. S-H-S-W-P-X-D. Again, that's Sierra Hotel Sierra Whiskey Papa X-Ray Delta. I feel so secret agent-y. And the letter you'll need to crack that code is my middle initial. Go to studio360.org. We've got a decoding chart there to help you out, and follow the instructions to decipher the password. And when you do, you can unlock that behind-the-scenes look at 2012's Comic-Con.
Now, let's see what's happening to Annie.
Tennessee Williams, A Streetcar Named Desire, always seems to be on stage someplace, or on TV, thanks to the iconic film performances by Marlon Brando and Vivian Leigh.
In the state of Louisiana, we got here what's known as the Napoleonic Code, according to which that what belongs to the wife belongs to the husband also, and vice versa.
No, but you have an impressive judicial air.
You know, if I didn't know that you was my wife's sister, I would get ideas about you.
She's what?
Don't place the dumb, you know what.
But a different version now on Broadway is trying something new. It's the first streetcar on a major stage to feature black and Latino actors in the lead roles. As Paul Vandekar tells us, that choice reveals something about the play, something that may have been hiding in plain sight.
You must be Stanley. I'm Blanche.
Oh, you Stella's sister.
Yes.
Hello. Where's little woman?
In the bathroom.
Oh. I know you coming in town. How long are you here for, Blanche?
I don't know yet.
You gonna shack up here?
Well, I thought I would if it wasn't inconvenient for you all.
Good.
We are really saturating the play with what I think of as a truly New Orleans production. And that means that it's multiracial and multiethnic.
That's Emily Mann. She's directing the new Broadway production. She says she's gotten some pointed criticism from within the theater community about the so-called alternative casting.
People have said, that it's a gimmick. It's absolutely not a gimmick. It goes deep, deep, deep into the heart and soul of what this play is really about, in my opinion.
African-American culture kind of floats around the edges of Tennessee Williams' script. Stella and Stanley have black neighbors, and Williams called for blue piano, played by, quote, Negro entertainers, to be heard throughout the play. Philosopher Cornel West says the blues isn't just incidental music.
The blues is a compassionate response to catastrophe. It could be in song, or it can be in a Tennessee Williams play. Catastrophe is a constant companion of the major protagonist of every play by Tennessee Williams. Certainly the blues is the creation of a black people's on the underside of a romantic project called the USA. And so it's no accident that Tennessee Williams and others incorporate a blues idiom in their understanding of America.
West even goes a little farther.
Well, Tennessee Williams, born Thomas Lanier in Columbus, Mississippi, is my soul brother. He's a white literary blues man of the highest order.
Now, the conflict is between a roughneck Polish-American worker and the daughter of an aristocratic old French family. But Emily Mann has envisioned Blanche and Stella Dubois as descendants of wealthy Creoles in Louisiana. She points to one little line spoken by Blanche.
So she says, oh yes, my American ancestors were French Huguenot. That's the line. And so if you say it as my American ancestors were French Huguenot, the others were African. And how we made historical sense of the class difference or different culture between Stanley and the Dubois sisters is through this, that he's a dark-skinned man with a very fair-skinned wife who comes from, you know, the plantation houses of York.
There's nothing in there that says this is about white people.
That's an actress named Carol Sutton. She was in an all-black production of Streetcar in New Orleans nearly 30 years ago. All of the characters here, she says, can be found in the black community.
People who were rich and then lost their fortune, people who go crazy, people who ne'er do well, and people who just mean people like Stanley, you know? So it just translates. I think a lot of Tennessee's plays translate very well to other cultures.
So it didn't matter so much that this was a plantation that Blanche lost, just sort of a fortune.
Black people had plantations. Black people had slaves. And, you know, in Louisiana, black people had slaves.
Harold Evans was also in the New Orleans production.
In Louisiana, within one immediate family, you could have a very fair-skinned individual who could be considered white by a lot of people, and you've got some darker people who are obviously black people. So in this area, we have that.
Now, technically, the Dubois family plantation is in Mississippi, not Louisiana, so it's unlikely that Tennessee Williams intended them to be Creoles. But by shaking up the cast of Streetcar, the new production opens up another level to the play that deals with our country's complicated racial history. For Cornel West, the key scene is when Blanche's boyfriend, Mitch, confronts her about her promiscuous past.
Yeah, that's when Mitch strips off the cover of the Chinese lantern, where you get, in fact, beyond the fakery of the posing and posturing of the American Hamlet, Blanche Dubois.
What it means is, I've not had a real good look at you, Blanche. Let's turn the light on here.
Light? What light? What for?
This one, with the paper thing on it.
What did you do that for?
So I can have a look at you good and
of
plain.
Of course you don't mean to be so insulted.
No.
Tell the truth about yourself. That's what Mitch is saying. To Blanche Dubois, who are you really when you take off the mask? Let me see your contradictions. Let me see your inadequacies. Let me see the you that you've been trying to hide and conceal, and she can't take it. That's America. America, who are you really?
In other words, West sees Streetcar as a blues play. The multiracial cast just makes that a little more obvious. And so it's no more a gimmick than Tennessee Williams' choice of piano music.
Was he just trying to add a little color I don't think so. I think he's trying to tell the truth. And that's what we're trying to do. Tell the truth.
For Studio 360, I'm Paul Vandekar.
This Streetcar Named Desire is on Broadway, but hurry if you want to see it. It closes next weekend, July 22nd. Coming up, women directors are proving you don't have to be an egomaniacal jerk to make a great movie. Well, not most of the time.
You know, it really wasn't hard for me to be Miss Bossy Pants.
I'll talk with filmmaker Lynn Shelton and other women about the changes taking place in a very male-dominated business. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Random House, publishers of the new novel True Believers by Kurt Anderson. Meet Karen Hollander, a celebrated lawyer who's about to reveal a secret past that will turn her life upside down. From the 1960s to the present, True Believers is part political thriller, part love story, and part chronicle of the ways we live now. In hardcover or ebook.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. I realized something recently. Half of my favorite films from the last few years happened to be directed by women. There was The Hurt Locker by Kathryn Bigelow, who became the first woman to win an Oscar for Best Director. And Persepolis, Marjane Satrapi's animated film about Iran. This spring, I loved the movie Friends with Kids, directed by Jennifer Westfeldt. And now, this summer, Your Sister's Sister by Lynn Shelton and Take This Waltz by Sarah Polley are absolute delights. So I got to thinking, have we reached a tipping point for women directors? Yes and no. Of the 250 big Hollywood movies that came out last year in America, women directed only 5% of them. But when it comes to commercial and critical breakthroughs among smaller independent films, a real shift seems to have happened. Sarah Polley noticed it, too.
When I had my very first short film at the Sundance Film Festival, I was looking desperately around for another female filmmaker, and I think I found two. And I remember when I had Away From Her there, 40% of the filmmakers at Sundance were women.
Sarah Polley's new film, Take This Waltz, is populated by characters who feel refreshingly real and particular, unlike most of the comedies and dramas Hollywood is now churning out. And Polley cast comedic actors like Seth Rogen and Sarah Silverman against type in serious roles. The scripts that come Silverman's way tend to be low-rent comedies. So she was surprised, thrilled, to get the part of a woman struggling unfunnily with alcoholism. In this scene, she confronts her philandering sister-in-law, played by Michelle Williams.
Hey!
Hi.
How you doing? I haven't seen you in a real long time.
Okay.
Really long time. Is this what it takes to get you back? How you been?
What happened, Geraldine?
I'm an alcoholic, moron. Nothing happened. This is my natural state. What happened? Really? Why wouldn't I ask that of you? You just disappeared, Margot. What a f***ing obvious move. You think that everything can be worked out if you just make the right move. That must be thrilling. I think it's thrilling. I don't agree.
If you look at the great movies that used to get made out of Hollywood, the characters were a pain in the butt. Like, you know, Betty Davis' characters were, like, difficult and prickly and brittle. And,
or Joan Crawford or Barbara Stanwyck.
They were, I know, they were, like, the idea of the broad used to be there. And that was sexy. It wasn't, like, the sideshow character actor part. It was, like, the main leading lady was a broad who was a real piece of work. And I think this idea that we have to like everybody all the time makes for really boring movies because we don't recognize ourselves in it. We all have a certain amount of self-loathing that's healthy. And I just think there's no room for tension or for things to be truly funny when everyone has to be nice all the time.
That's a great point. And, or for the audience to figure out, do I like her? Don't I like her? How do I like her?
Yeah, and how can I like this person when these things about them are so objectionable, which is how we feel about so many people in our lives.
To understand why directors like Sarah Polley are thriving, I also talked with Ann Thompson, one of our best film journalists. She's been at Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, and now runs the blog Thompson on Hollywood. She says, look at how the independent scene has changed since its first heyday in the early 90s. Films like Take This Waltz can now be shot quickly, nimbly, cheaply. And the low budgets force the process to be very collaborative.
I think that is their strength, and I think that the new indie model that is emerging is a much more kind of collaborative barter talent, share roles, do writing, do directing, do producing, bring in friends to help you. And all these filmmakers are sort of roaming the country, helping each other make films in all these different locations and all these different ranges of experience. And it works. It works. Women are really good at that kind of thing. And that's exactly what Lynn Shelton is doing.
The budget for Lynn Shelton's new movie, Your Sister's Sister, was $125,000, about 5% or less of what it cost to make one episode of a big-time TV show. She shot it in 12 days, which was luxurious compared to her previous film, the comedy Hump Day.
For me as a director, my passion is finding the scene with the actors and really unlocking, you know, what's the shape of this thing and how are we going to really get it good? And as opposed to spending a whole day setting up the perfect crane shot, you know. So on a normal movie set out of a 12-hour day, the actor works about 1.5-2 hours, maybe tops. And in this scenario, it's the opposite. So they're working really hard and a lot, like 10, 11 hours out of the 12-hour day because there isn't that much lighting. You know, there's not that much technical stuff.
You shoot digitally? Or
yes, so that I can just, I mean, Hump Day, we had 40-minute takes sometimes.
40-minute takes. In the old days of expensive film, that wouldn't have been possible, which is why small, arty movies used to look so rough around the edges. But Lynn Shelton's Your Sister's Sister is beautiful and fully cinematic.
And it's wonderful because it means that people can actually just do what I do, which is pick up a camera and call up your friends and say, let's go make a movie. And that was our philosophy with Hump Day. It was like, you know, we're really going to go for it. We're going to try and make a believable movie out of this ridiculous premise. And if we fail, like, we'll just shove it under the rug. Like, you know, we don't have any big studio.
That's
you know?
Nice, which is so unmovie-like. Writers do that all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But it's very low stakes, you know, when you're able to do it this way.
Which is why the acting in her films feels so natural. In this scene from Your Sister's Sister, Mark Duplass comes upon Rosemarie DeWitt drinking all by herself.
So, you're on an island. It's 3 a.m. And you're drinking by yourself.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Really?
I'm not good for small talk, so I apologize if I'm barging through the doors of your privacy
now. Yeah, it's okay. You kind of are, but
I apologize. Let's talk about your slippers.
Okay, let's talk about my slippers.
Your slippers are awesome.
I just walked out on a 7-year relationship.
Whoa.
Hence the tequila.
Hence the tequila.
I am a control freak. I'm a total control freak. And so it was terrifying to be on the set of my first feature. I'd only been on the post side before I actually directed my own. And I'm going up to everybody saying, hi, what's your name? How are you? What's your job? A gaffer. What do they do? You know, like I really was like film school.
Did you have to learn how to be the commander? Because even on any kind of movie, the director is the autocrat.
You know, it really wasn't hard for me to be Miss Bossy Pants. You
were just waiting for the opportunity?
It turns out, yeah. And I realized, too, I remember my very first day of directing in my first feature, and about halfway through the day, I remember going to the bathroom and looking at the myself in the mirror and sort of saying, you know, it really, I'm just doing my job just like everybody else. Like everybody has, it's like I'm a cog in the machine. There's this beautiful, well-oiled machine. Everybody knows what their job is. And mine just happens to be having the vision of the overall creative vision for what it is that we're actually doing there.
Sarah Polley says this new generation of female filmmakers may be changing the very idea of what a director is supposed to be.
The stereotype of a director has also been defined by this idea of this kind of, you know, macho attitude of also, you know, I know everything, I can do everything, I'm capable of everything, when in fact it's a completely collaborative medium, probably more so than any other art form. I'm hoping that will shift as there are more female directors, that we don't have to maintain this charade of us knowing the entire process as though we're just, you know, have hired people to do what we don't have hands to do. The truth is we rely heavily on our cinematographers, on our production designers, on our, you know, costume designers, and on our actors to do what we can't do ourselves.
And what about that positive gender stereotype of women are better at that kind of more subtle bossiness and the collaborative nature. Is that true in your experience?
It's true and not true. I've worked with some great male directors who are also very, very collaborative, and some really dictatorial women. So I don't think it's so obviously that, but yeah, I think in a very, very generalized way, I think women can be good at admitting what they don't know more readily, and I think that can kind of get held against them at times in the current climate. But
who holds it against them?
I feel like, you know, when you're promoting a film, for instance, people kind of want a strong personality. People kind of want to know that you were some kind of mad, tormented artiste.
Be the auteur.
Yes, and that made people crazy, and, you know, they have such a distinct way of working, and the question I love is, how did you get that performance out of that actor? So everything you've done has been, you know, sort of Machiavellian.
I shot a pistol behind his head and he wasn't aware. With all these indie women directors making such extraordinary work now, you'd think the studios would be banging down their doors, asking Sarah Polley, Lynn Shelton, Lisa Cholodenko, Jennifer Westfeld, or Catherine Bigelow to give a fresh spin on the next alien invasion / superhero / secret agent blockbuster. Uh-uh. Here's the journalist Ann Thompson.
Catherine Bigelow is an enormous exception, and the reason that she was able to make The Hurt Locker was that she did it, first of all, she's known for being a man's director in a way. She puts men in her movies. She does action. She's not doing female genres, and she's resolutely not interested in doing them. But what she did do was do it independently, and the Bin Laden movie that's coming up later this year was raised overseas as well. And if women can raise their own funding, then they can get the movies made.
And will this change? I mean, will in 10 years, will we see women directing what have been traditionally male movies, big action movies, big budget movies, CG movies, all of it?
No. I've been watching this a really long time, you know, and it depresses me no end. And I don't think that a studio had, even Amy Pascal, you know.
Who runs a studio.
Has had her hand slapped, you know, when she's tried to make so-called chick flicks. They've done badly. She's been chastised for it. Therefore, she's putting a recast version of Spider-Man out this summer that has absolutely no reason for being. You know, that's what they think they have to do, as smart as they are. And they are smart. That's what kills me.
Sarah Polley agrees. There's still this stereotype that women are only fit to make what they mostly get to make. Intimate character pieces focusing on relationships.
Women aren't really trusted with anything else right now. I mean, I know female filmmakers who would love to make, you know, an action film or, you know, a horror film or some kind of thriller, and they just don't get the financing for those kinds of movies. So I think that women aren't necessarily trusted with subject matter other than this. It happens to be what I'm interested in, to make these intimate character dramas, and I'm lucky. But if I ever wanted to do something else, I think it would be more challenging.
For the last few decades, Hollywood has more than ever been putting its chips on male directors making movies for teenaged males. But recent would-be blockbusters like Battleship and John Carter, total flops. Ann Thompson.
I mean, the studios are stumbling right now. They don't know how to make romantic comedies anymore. They don't know how to make dramas. They're terrified of these genres because they're so execution dependent. And they seem to be completely avoiding the fact that there's, you know, a huge demand for movies that are aimed at women, that have a women's point of view. And there's demonstrable statistical evidence that movies like Mamma Mia and, you know, Bridesmaids do really, really well at the box office. So why don't the studios pay attention to this? It's because they're used to doing things the old way, and they're used to hanging on to these old conventional ideas.
They'd better come to their senses soon, because a giant screen and giant speakers and $8 popcorn aren't enough to get me to a theater to see the same old boys and their toys. Studio 360's Eric Molinsky produced this segment with me, and you can hear my full interviews with Sarah Polley and Lynn Shelton at studio360.org. Coming up, when he was 13, Dave Longstreth heard that the Beatles had created their most sophisticated work using four-track tape recorders.
It just gave me the sense that, like, oh, like, we can do something like this.
You mean if they can make Sgt. Pepper's with this relatively primitive technology, we can do anything?
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Dirty Projectors perform for us live next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. I'm Kurt Anderson. This is Studio 360. The music critic Tim Page is a friend of mine in real life and on Facebook. A few weeks ago, he posted on Facebook about music that he never really wanted to hear again. Not bad music, great music that's just been played to death. And he really touched a nerve. Dozens and dozens of Facebook users posted comments. It seems a lot of us, maybe all of us, have a short list of good music, great music sometimes, that's been ruined by repetition. And Tim Page joins me now. Welcome back to the show.
It's good to see you again, Kurt.
So was there a particular piece of music that was the straw that broke the camel's back that inspired this post?
Well, I just was thinking of all these pieces. You know, they're perfectly good pieces. Nothing wrong with them at all. But I've heard them too much.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a guy in his late 50s, and I've been listening to, say, Sgt. Pepper since I was 13 or 14. And yeah, it's wonderful. It's a great album. I want everyone to hear Sgt. Pepper, but I don't need to hear it again. Also, I was a music critic for many years, and I remember, I would say by the fourth or fifth time I'd covered Madame Butterfly, I'd said pretty much everything I had to say about it. And then because it was part of the repertory, I, you know, had to cover it maybe another 25 or 30 times. And, you know, I'm just at a point where I just don't want to hear this either.
Do you have a sense that there's a number? Like, is it the 100th time? Is it how much is too much to have heard a given piece of music?
Well, I don't know exactly, because there are certain pieces I can listen to again and again and again and not get sick of. I mean, there's some rock recordings from the 60s, 70s, even beyond that, that I've been listening to for a long time. Oh, I don't know, the Astral Weeks or...
the Van Morrison record.
Yeah, the Van Morrison record.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream.
After the Gold Rush, I can listen to again and again. I can listen to some old Beatles recordings all the time. In my opinion, and I think nobody would be more surprised by this than my younger self, I like the early stuff better now than I like the later stuff. I'm much happier with Help or Rubber Soul or Revolver. But I was just thinking about just some records that don't really quite work. One that particularly bugs me, and again, I'm going to keep covering myself saying there's nothing wrong with it at all.
Not that there's anything wrong with
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Is Take Five. Anytime
Dave
you
Brubeck.
Hear... Yeah, Dave Brubeck. Anytime you hear a jazz record somewhere, it's going to be Take Five.
Yeah.
If it's not, you know, something else. Give me some Miles Davis.
As people, as all these dozens and dozens of people were provoked to comment by your Facebook post, were you surprised by any of the suggestions that they had of don't play this anymore?
Well, one of the things that struck me was some of them didn't really understand what I was asking. Somebody wrote, oh, I never want to hear A Horse with No Name again. Well, I don't want to hear A Horse with No Name
the first place.
You know Randy Newman's wonderful description of that. He says it's this song about these kids who think they've taken acid, which I always thought was pretty hilarious. But that wasn't really what I was after. I mean, that's fine. We can all name pieces
right.
we hate.
But that's not as interesting.
It's not as interesting.
I've been through the desert on a horse with no name.
One that a lot of people mentioned was Carmina Burana. Now, for me, I don't want to hear Carmina Burana very often, but if I hear it once a year, I'm just fine, and I'm enjoying it enormously, and I actually get very much involved in the piece. I just don't want to hear it for another year once it's over.
Are there things that the pieces that you don't want to hear again, is there something they have in common, or just is it just a quirk of Tim Page?
Well, you know, I have this theory about allergies and affinities, which I want to turn into an essay at some point, about how we are naturally drawn to, say, certain people, drawn to certain works of art. Maybe we like those people better than they, quote unquote, deserve to be liked, or a film better than that. And then there are also things for which we don't really have much of a fondness for. Indeed, you could call it an allergy. There are works that I am entirely willing to grant are masterpieces that I just never want to hear, period. And there are pieces which I recognize have a certain amount of cheapness to them and perhaps even wildly obviousness to them that I can listen to again and again. And I think we all are sort of like this.
Coming out of this experience, have you put together your definitive list of 57 pieces of music?
Not yet, but if somebody wants me to do it, they can contact me.
Excellent. Tim Page, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
And we'd like to know the piece of music you never need to hear again. Go to studio360.org to add your song to our Do Not playlist. Again, we're not talking about bad music, but good music that's just terminally overplayed. Classical, pop, jazz, country, whatever. Add your song and tell us your story at studio360.org. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Dirty Projectors are an indie band who managed to be both avant-garde and accessible. An arty band you can still dance to.
Look around at everyone. Everyone looks alive and waiting.
That song is Cannibal Resource from their last record, Bitte Orca, in 2009. Since then, Dirty Projectors have collaborated with Bjork, been covered by Solange Knowles, the sister of Beyoncé, and now have a new album called Swing Low Magellan. Dirty Projectors, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So will you start with a song in this beautifully stripped down, unplugged condition?
We will.
And what's it going to be?
Yeah, it's called Just From Chevron.
Excellent.
Where she collapses into the shore, pump her like product and ask her for more. There a man lay dying in ice, gasket had busted and
Orleans. I'm going down to a great good extent. Now all the air is quiet and still. Wish I was back home. Wherever the people drive, what sort of way will be left? All my friends, my enemies too, live in the shadows of the day. While winds always whistling an infinite tune. Don't think I won't try when I close my eyes. Wherever the people will drive, that's where I will be lying. Don't think I won't try. When I close my eyes, wherever the people will drive, that's where I will be lying. 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 That's where I will be lying.
That was Dirty Projectors performing Just from Chevron from their new album Swing Low Magellan. Dave Longstreth, will you introduce these three people singing beautifully with you?
Sure. It's Amber Kaufman to my right, Haley Deagle just in front of me, and sitting in with us this week, Jen Wozner from Wyoke.
Hello.
The songs like that one that you write are musically, in addition to lyrically complex, more complex musically than most rock songs. Does that come out of having studied orchestration and harmonic theory and so forth at Yale?
I don't know. I mean, I did that stuff, but I think I did that stuff just because I'm curious about sounds. I'm curious about music. Curious about, you know, songwriting, putting things together.
Well, one way that you've put things together on your last record, Bitta Orca, you had the band watch the movie Wings of Desire and then write lyrics in response to that film. Did you do anything like that for this new record?
This album was it's different. It's more it's a little bit more internal, and it comes a little bit more out of I guess experience. I guess you could say that Bitta Orca, it's like the things that we as a band were really interested in were kind of like surfaces and textures and colors and, you know, explicitly musical things. Lyrics came kind of secondarily, and they're a little bit more at the heart of the new record. So I guess I didn't really play games quite like that this time around.
As a kid, what kind of music did you listen to in the 80s, 90s, growing up that sort of formed you musically?
Well, you know, there was my parents' record collection. They graduated college in 1970, so they have all that
all that stuff.
That would be the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the...
Yeah, all that stuff. And then I have an older brother who's about 5 years older than me who got super into just like, you know, punk music. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, all kinds of music, whether it's the weird, you know, kaleidoscopic orchestrations of like Ligeti in the 60s or whether it's like, you know, Greg Ginn's approach to the guitar in the late 70s. Or Stravinsky's way of orchestrating winds, or like, you know, Jeff Emmerich's approach to miking the drum kit. There's a world of amazing, amazing music and sounds.
I've read that you read when you were young this book of that just minutely deconstructs Beatles songwriting, Revolution in the Head, and that was a big deal for you.
Yeah.
How so?
Well, I was really into like four-track recording at the time, and it just blew my mind that a lot of those Beatles records were made on four tracks, albeit, you know, very different four tracks and with different mics and all that stuff. But it just gave me the sense that like, oh, like we can do something like this. My brother and I just like sitting in our bedroom, like.
You mean if they can make Sgt. Pepper's with this relatively primitive technology, we can do anything?
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah.
So how old were you when that eureka moment happened?
Probably 13 or 14.
And at 13 with your brother, what on your machine in your bedroom, what kind of music were you making?
That's pretty similar to the stuff that we do now in Dirty Projectors. It's just voices and guitars and drums.
And you've collaborated, as I mentioned, with Bjork. You've collaborated with David Byrne. How did those come about? And do you have like a checklist of, oh, I want to get to this person and this person and work with them as well?
No, I don't. But yeah, I mean, definitely David Byrne and Bjork were like big heroes of mine. And the new album is very kind of insular in the way that it's just me and it's the band. Those things were, you know, they were amazing and really, really fulfilling. And we learned so much from working with those people because they're just masters of their craft and kind of great people as well. But no, there's no master plan to seek out.
Sir Paul McCartney will be next. Or...
Lil Wayne, Lindsey Buckingham.
Yeah, that's
Lil
true.
Lil Wayne.
Well, Dave Longstreth and Dirty Projectors, I want to thank you for coming. And will you play us... out with another song?
Sure, yeah. Let's play a song called Impregnable Question.
Excellent.
If there is ever the impregnable question of why, what did or didn't pass, it would help to see. Forward side by side.
shed it all. We have both stood tall. What is mine is yours, and happiness is in strife. You are my love, and I want you in my life. You are my love, and I want you in my life. You are my love, and I want you in my life.
And that was Dirty Projectors playing Impregnable Question from their new record, Swing Low Magellan. You can hear another track they perform for us at our website, studio360.org. And that is it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen next time. By the way, between broadcasts, you can find us and news stories all the time on Flipboard, on Google Currents, and at studio360.org. While you're there, don't forget to nominate some great but overexposed songs for our Do Not playlist. We'll be announcing the results in a couple of weeks. Over on Twitter, you can find me at KB Anderson. That's S-E-N. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Julia Barton,
Mujahid Solomon,
Eve Asher,
Julia Wetherill.
And as always, thanks to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
The creator of Breaking Bad is the farthest thing from a druggie.
I hate to admit, I've never even done marijuana. I'm the strangest guy in the world to be running a show about crystal meth, yeah.
Breaking Bad's Vince Gilligan, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.